So now, I'd like to share a few words about our speaker today. Nora Pfeiffer is a Renaissance woman. She is multi-talented, deeply knowledgeable on a wide range of topics, and carries limitless curiosity and creativity. While her talents are most visible when she's acting, Nora plays many other roles that you may not be aware of. In addition to being a gifted actor, she is an equally talented writer, director, producer of both theater and film. She's a compassionate and rigorous teacher, and she's also an astonishing graphic designer. The programs you hold when you come to a Firelight show are Nora's work, among other things. Now, there are other full-time roles, which include mother of Kazi and Rootsy, wife and partner with her beloved Adar, dedicated daughter, sister, and dear friend. Now, you also may not be aware of Nora's pedigree, which extends far beyond our community here. Before Nora, Adar, and then 1.5-year-old Rootsy moved to Peterborough, she was a celebrated actor in Chicago. She enjoyed a prolific 10-year career performing at some of the most respected theaters in the country. I first encountered Nora as an actor in We Were Friends. I was impressed and immediately smitten. We met again several months later, just after she'd returned from Chicago, where she was shooting her first feature film, a film that she wrote and directed and produced. And I was completely blown away by her exuberance. On screen in the Firelight film Dinner Time, I found her reactions alone mesmerizing. But these are just some of the visible public gifts that Nora shares. After joining the Firelight board, I had an intimate view of her behind the scenes. I noticed early on that she was constantly talking about the audience. She was thinking about and imagining the audience in every meeting and conversation we had, this community. It was clear to me at every turn that Nora is a gem in our midst, a consummate professional, first-rate talent in every role she embraces. Now, here's what one of her closest collaborators had to say about Nora. Passionate, intelligent, curious, and savvy, Nora is, as they say, multitudes. She is skilled, inventive, and ever-changing. Nora is also very funny and eats her lunch very early in the day. So before we get started, I'd like to share a few fun facts about Nora. She has an exceptionally advanced sense of direction and navigation. In high school, Nora developed a drama curriculum for students with special learning needs as a capstone project, and the curriculum was so helpful, it continued long after she graduated. And Nora once performed a solo show in Amsterdam with her body covered in pancakes. A few numbers on Nora. She can recite the alphabet backwards in 3 seconds. She usually sneezes 4 times. And Nora can swim continuously for miles, although I'm not sure of that exact number. Finally, I'd like to quote what a local actor shared with me about working with Nora. Nora's ethos is all about connection and response in the moment. She is not trying to get us to be good or funny or brilliant. Her approach is incredibly liberating as she trusts us to find the scene in each other. Nora is the first director who ever made me feel like I was an artist. We are so very fortunate that Nora has chosen to share her huge heart and talents here in this community. So please give a warm welcome to Nora Pfeiffer.
A moment ago, I was seated in that chair. I listened to Volkert's music. I listened to Michelle introduce me. I clocked some familiar faces in the audience, made some eye contact. Several moments ago, I was at home. I drank coffee, had eggs. I had a dance party with my family in the kitchen, and then on my way out the door, both kids handed me a good luck charm. But the moment just before I came on stage, into the frame of our time together, I was seated in that back room. There were fake flowers on the table, two glasses of ice water. Michelle and I chatted. I checked the mirror. And then Jean told me it was time to come out. I walked very carefully. I wore sensible shoes because I have a slight limp on my right side, and I wanted to feel secure, ready, confident. We all have a moment before. Before the lights came up, before the camera started rolling, before we walked into a room, before we got out of the car, before we picked up the phone, before we said hello. We're all coming from somewhere before each scene change of our day. And these moments before will inform the next moment, which will, of course, inform the next. Your moment before arriving here may have been finding a really good parking space, feeling proud of yourself, or leaving on time. Or maybe it was having an extra long goodbye with your child down in the childcare room and wondering if it was the right decision to come. Maybe you drank just the right amount of coffee, or maybe not. Maybe you got a bee sting and it still hurts. Maybe you got a phone call and it wasn't the news you really wanted to hear today. Or maybe you said hello to someone you're fond of and you couldn't remember their name and you wondered if they could tell. Will someone share their moment before arriving here? Simply the thing that happened to you before you walked in the door. Yes. He loaded a trampoline into his truck and passed it off to a friend quickly. Any other moments before? Just what happened? She saw a friend across the street walking her dog and said hi. We had a parking observation with quite a bit of point of view, which we'll get to. And so now we're in this scene together. We're scene partners. Me up here at this podium with this microphone, and you, the audience, including the members who just spoke with us. This has never happened before. I haven't stood up here with you looking at me and listening. And this particular group of people has never assembled in this arrangement and at this time and with these fans blowing and with each and every moment before that brought you here today. And of course, this will never happen again. Even if we all showed up here tomorrow, same people, same seats, similar weather, we'd all be a little different. We'd all have a different moment before. So this is it. This is the only time this is going to happen. It's all new. So if we're going to be scene partners, we've got to be right here with each other in this moment. And in this moment, and all the moments to come, we've got to trust each other. You already know something about me. You know that I have a slight limp on my right side. You know that I drank coffee this morning and danced. You know that I wore sensible shoes. You know that I'm today's speaker in the Monadnock Lyceum, and you know a bit about my work because my bio is in the program. These are some of my given circumstances, the indisputable facts about a character, usually provided by the playwright or the screenwriter. She's an actor, a writer, a director. She has a slight limp, or at least she thinks she does. A few more of my given circumstances. I'm from Evanston, Illinois. I'm a middle child. I went to sleepaway debate camp this summer I turned 15. Just like our moments before, we all have given circumstances. Maybe you also aren't from around here. Maybe you were the last of your friends to learn how to ride a bike. Maybe you have 6 overdue library books on your nightstand. Would someone please share one of their given circumstances, an indisputable fact, not an opinion or reflection? That's the audience's job. Just a fact.
I sing every day with my three mini schnauzers.
She sings every day with her 3 mini schnauzers. She also grew up in Evanston, Illinois. He can wiggle his toe, his little toe, without moving the rest of his toes. Maybe hearing some of these given circumstances reminds you of some of yours, or maybe you're wondering why you can't think of anything at all. Who am I, you wonder? Has anything ever happened to me ever? One more given circumstance. He played hockey in Evanston, Illinois in 3rd grade. We've also got shared given circumstances, some of them having to do with Evanston, but mostly here, we're in this sanctuary together. It's sunny out, the room is bright. So, scene partner, we're made up of given circumstances, we're made up of moments before, we're also made up of wants. In a juicy acting scene in a play or a movie, we often see 2 characters who want different things. Character A wants character B to stay, but character B wants to go. Character A wants forgiveness, but character B wants to make A suffer. These opposing objectives are what make conflict. It's what makes a scene feel dramatic. And a really good scene has opposing objectives with 2 characters who have something to lose or something to gain if they do or don't get what they want. These are the stakes. The higher the stakes, the more our hearts start to race. Unlike the work I do in the fictional world, my hope for today is that you and I don't have opposing objectives. This is one of those scenes where I hope the characters want the same thing, to be on the same side. I want to succeed today, to feel proud of this exchange. I want to open up to you. I want to share my love of theater and filmmaking with you, and I want you to love it too. But really, what it comes down to is, I want you to like me. I want you to respect me. I want you to love me. I really do. Most days when I walk into a room, or pick up the phone, or get out of my car, or say hello, I want my scene partner, whoever it is, it's my primal want, my everlasting, deepest, most basic want. It's nearly always there. You've got 1 or 2, too. Is it to feel secure? To feel seen? To be independent? To feel needed? To be the best? I like that one. I want to be your favorite. Would someone share a deepest want? Probably the first thing that comes to mind.
I want you to love me.
Mm-hmm. He wants love too. Anybody else? He wants to be independent. Anybody else?
I want to be safe.
She wants to be safe. You, my collective scene partner, are showing up. You're showing up with your given circumstances, your moments before, your wants. These are the elements, I believe, that make us feel deeply connected to the characters we see on stage, on screen, and all around us every day. My goal when I'm performing or guiding actors through performance is to connect. Being in partnership is an exchange, a two-way street, to see and be seen, to give and receive. I'm a bit allergic to the word speech or monologue. My hope is to always be in dialogue, even if I'm doing most of the talking. When I was a senior in high school, I was in an interdisciplinary program called Senior Studies. We got to design our own independent projects, initiate our own internships. Individuality and independence were celebrated. So the times that the group met as a whole felt especially precious. In a surprising move, our teachers warned us that at the end of the week, they'd be holding a mandatory talent show for all 60 kids. This group of students was a real cross-section of our already very diverse and very big high school. I was one of the only theater kids and probably one of the only academically obsessed kids, and I was pretty quiet in class. A talent show at age 8 is a thrill. At age 18, it's a panic. To name your talent, share it, and wait for applause sounded like a nightmare, even for someone who liked to be on stage. A tennis player, classmate of mine, a girl I'd known since middle school, attempted friendly conversation during a break in class. "So are you gonna do a monologue?" Lisa asked. A monologue? I felt an immediate allergy to the idea. Was she going to get up on stage and hit a tennis ball against the wall? Is that what people thought about actors? That we love to command the attention of a room and present an out-of-context, high-stakes speech with no way in for the audience to experience the moment? To show it to them instead of invite them into the story? Most actors, I'm convinced, loathe monologues. It robs us of our moment before. It robs us of our scene partner. And our scene partner is everything. The connection to our scene partner is what holds our relationship. This is who we are to the person we are talking with. Character relationship helps to define our point of view. It's where the listening happens. It's where the moment-to-moment connection happens, where we are permeable enough to be surprised, reactive, and make choices from a place informed by the person we share the stage with. A monologue. I was sick to my stomach. I don't remember what I said to Lisa. I probably said something that sounded like yes, but my wheels started turning. If a monologue is what this motley crew of high school seniors expected from the theater kid, what could I give them instead? What's not on their wish list, but will surprise and delight them? The night before the talent show, I stayed up past midnight cutting large pieces of foam, gathering ping pong balls and wooden chopsticks, turning my old dress-up fabric into scraps. I found a small flannel shirt that my brother wore when he was little, and I piled up unattached socks. With these supplies, I made 5 ragtag puppets with a lot of personality. The next day, when it was my turn to share my talent, I solemnly approached the stage. I could feel my peers bracing for an out-of-nowhere and out-of-context dramatic 2 minutes from a play they didn't know. They were giving me the respect of already turning serious. I was serious too. I marched onto the stage. I found my light. I moved a stool to the center I brought out a second stool a couple feet away. I draped a white sheet over the two stools, and then, looking directly at the audience, I sank down and disappeared behind my makeshift curtain. I cued the music. The opening number from the animated Beauty and the Beast movie started to play. From behind the sheet, out emerged an adorable homemade puppet with ping pong ball eyes, black shoelace hair, and chopsticks that operated her foam hands. She sang about the provincial town, how she longed for more books, how she was misunderstood. The audience was so confused. This was not the meal they ordered. This one wasn't on the menu. And yet, they liked it. This performance, the randomness and ridiculousness of it, acknowledged their expectations and subverted them. We were all in on it. This isn't what any of us expected, but here we are, together. Out popped a burly lumberjack puppet wearing my brother's flannel from when he was a toddler, and the swooning chorus girls, three sock puppets that I had to switch constantly on my left hand, a feat that no two-handed person could master. It was the attempt that was funny. I gave them a break. I didn't give them work to do. I gave them and myself a gift. Pleasure. Pleasure can come in so many forms in performance. For this, it was subverting expectations for myself and for my audience. Being silly and ironic and serious about something ridiculous was the recipe. This was the first time I really thought about my audience and the responsibility and opportunity we have when we're granted one. A monologue, in this case, wouldn't have been a gift. It would have been a chore. Giving the audience something they want doesn't mean giving the audience something that they have asked for. Giving the audience what they want is giving them something they didn't know they would enjoy, but it fits just right. It's thinking about your audience like your best friend on their birthday. What's not on their list, but would make their day? What is it that will surprise and delight them? Challenge them. Make them curious, make them feel a little deeper. Performance, theater, film, a presentation, an interview, an important conversation, a meeting, these can all be gifts. What does the audience want, but they haven't asked for? My favorite experiences as an audience member are when I don't feel like a voyeur spying on something outside of myself. It's when I feel complicit in the action that I feel that I'm a vital contributor, that my unique chemistry, combined with the unique chemistry of everyone else in this room, made the experience one of a kind. I was needed. Not every gift exchange works out. Many times I've received a gift that doesn't fit quite right, or I already have it, or it isn't my style. But wow, the risk of giving a gift, I respect it. You, scene partner, already know what I want, because I told you. I want your love. I wonder at this moment how I'm doing with my objective. How can I get what I want? What do I have to do to get it? To not only be loved by you, but to be your favorite. How embarrassing. When I was in my early 20s, I was living in Chicago and working as an actor in the incredible storefront theater scene. I was doing a lesser-known Lillian Hellman play in a small black box theater. I was playing a young and powerless French housekeeper who works in a boarding house and, in a surprising turn, blackmails a guest so that she can return to France. She was quiet and sneaky. At the time, my now husband and I were hosting exchange students from all over the world. Our first roommate was from Leipzig, Germany, tall, blonde, blue-eyed, direct. She'd been in town for just a few days, and I encouraged her to come see the play I was in. I thought it'd be a great way for her to get to know the city, to see something that we could talk about, and there were actors like me doing exciting accent work. I didn't see her right after the show, but like any devoted actor, I cornered her the next morning and asked what she thought of the play. She leaned against the counter, searching for English words. She said, and get ready for more exciting accent work, I was, how do you say it, embarrassed for you? Yes, yes. Playing a character we are not is preposterous. As actors, we commit to it fully, with lights, costumes, in this case, a French accent, and we dare to ask people to come on the ride. But I don't believe it's much different from a presentation, an interview, a toast, a tricky conversation, a favor we have to ask. I believe we slip into character and relationship all day long. Waiting in line and chatting with a friend and suddenly shifting voice and body and objective to put in our drink order with the barista. Talking to a kid and then talking to their parent. We connect differently to different people because we want something different from each partner. I want the barista to think I'm nicer than the other customers. I want the kid to think I'm funny. I want my friend to feel safe with me. I want the parent to think I'm cool. When we move from scene partner to scene partner, or even moment to moment with the same scene partner, our wants shift, our point of view shifts, our relationship evolves. When we show up, give and receive, really listen, commit to the unknown next moment, it's all pretty embarrassing. I wrote and directed a feature film called Another Happy Day, a postpartum depression comedy. I'm so proud of this. It took nearly 10 years to complete the project, from writing the script to releasing the film. A clip from the film played on The Tonight Show when our lead actress was a guest. It was absolutely thrilling. I made this movie with so many crucial collaborators whose fingerprints are all over the project. At one of the film festivals I screened at, a humiliating snafu happened with the film file, and the first screening was a disaster. The file hadn't been formatted correctly, so the framing was completely off. Have you ever heard Martin Scorsese's classic quote that a director's job is to decide what gets in the frame and what doesn't? In this file, there was no frame. You could see the boom mic. It was raw. I watched the film alongside our audience and actors and wanted to truly crawl into a hole and never come out. I thought, why make anything? We have no control. Why work for years to get to the point of sharing, only for it to all feel so utterly stupid and embarrassing? Why do anything? At this festival, each film was screened twice. I couldn't imagine going through this again. There was no time to correct and test and submit a new file. I tried. But there was time to reframe. For the second screening, I asked to introduce my own film to the audience, and I confessed the snafu. It was now our inside joke. We then watched the movie together. It was a full house, full of laughter, and it was my favorite screening we've had to date. A friend who'd seen both screenings asked me how I'd been able to re-edit the film in 24 hours. How had I fixed the problem? I hadn't. It was the same file, unchanged. The only difference was the audience, and my reframing of the film with the audience. The problem bound us together. We were all complicit. An obsession with the audience experience is one of the driving forces at Firelight Theater Workshop, the intimate theater workshop here in Peterborough that I co-founded with fellow theater artist Jason Lambert. I treasure having a playground and playmates dedicated to devising original work. Our preoccupation with the audience compels us to surprise, delight, and trust them, to redefine the experience of live performance. Collaboratively, we have created more than 20 site-specific, immersive, intimate, and deeply meaningful plays and films for a dedicated and expanding audience. At the beginning of each project and all along the way, we ask, How will the audience experience this? What will they be expecting? And then what will happen? What is their relationship to the space? How will the space feel different after this experience? We've actually performed here in this sanctuary. I was up there in the balcony drawing. I dropped my pencil over the ledge, and my scene partner, Jason, stationed right where I am, walked over, picked up the pencil, and tossed it up. He later exited through those doors, walked up the stairs, and joined me up there. The characters met. They drew pictures of each other. They played hide and seek in the pews. They exchanged fake names. They became friends. When I'm here in this space, I remember that that also happened here. In another Firelight project, we rented out the local bagel shop, the Bagel Mill. The audience enters the cafe on a dark winter night and takes their seats facing a table for two by the window. Jason's character, Ralph, enters from the restroom behind the audience and heads outside into the snowy night. The employee finishes cleaning, hits the lights, locks up, and leaves. The audience, now seated alone in the dark, can see nothing but the illuminated parking lot through an oversized picture window. They can see Ralph bumping into my character, his dear friend Margaret, waving a metal detector over a snowbank. I'm looking for something I've lost. We're both bundled and mic'd, the sound of our voices piping right into the bagel shop. This encounter, the audience discovers, will not take place at that two-top by the window. The show will happen outdoors, through the frame of the window. An overheard conversation of the most private and playful nature. At Firelight, we write much of our own work, and we also produce great plays other artists have written. We probably read 50 plays before we land on the one we think we should produce at that moment. We've been fortunate to assemble teams of creative and game collaborators here in this community, each offering a range of interdisciplinary experience they bring to the project. Finding a new proximity to the audience or talking to them directly before a film screening are a couple of vital ways to connect with the audience. But this connection must be present throughout the whole theater or filmmaking process, during the writing, the rehearsal, the staging, the filming, the editing, the marketing. How do we connect our storytelling with an audience before the audience is there? As a director, there are two critical ways I set a project in motion so that this kind of connection will be made possible: preparation and communication. To prepare for a project, I create something I call an actor care package. It's a colorful, evocative document crafted for each character with reference images and drawings, a poem and a playlist. Essentially, a sensorial launch pad to get the juices flowing and set us up with a shared vocabulary. This frees us from the text and any preconceived notions we have about the character. Using our other senses helps us to feel the character instead of decide who they are or who they aren't. It helps the actor start to find their character's point of view. And then, once we're in rehearsal for a play or on set for a film, I prioritize communication. It's my job to have a clear vision, to be nimble and adaptable, and to communicate with each collaborator as an individual. With actors, I love to talk with them from their character's point of view. I'm on their side. I want the actor to feel inseparable from their character's point of view. It's not about nailing down a line reading or striving to make everything identical for each performance. I trust actors. As long as they are living in their point of view, the way they say their lines may well vary. I sure hope it does. So no matter if it's take one or take 10 or opening night or closing night, the performance is alive. We're not trying to chase a past take or a past rehearsal. We're simply staying loyal to the character's point of view. That way, the actors are present and available to their scene partner, where the real electricity happens. An audience can feel this electricity, right? You know the difference. You know if something is alive or not. A performance that's truly alive is a gift that says, you were needed. You needed to be here for this. It would have been different if you weren't here. We can't always see you, but we can always feel you. On the first day of rehearsal for my film, I was working privately with the lead, an extraordinary comedian. She's a terrific actress and often cast in strictly funny roles. The role in this film was a demanding one, on screen every moment on a wildly emotional ride. The actress and I sat together, holding our scripts. There was a warmth in the room and a caution, too. Some nerves on both our parts. You know, she said, there are a lot of times in the script where it says my character cries. I can't do that. We joked about how some actors pride themselves on crying on command, a badge that neither one of us wear, and one that frankly gives me pause. By the way, I said, that script is really for the reader, not the actor. When I wrote, she cries, what I really meant was that something has shifted for the character. It never has to be tears. The tension in the room lifted. The nerves dissipated. We could begin digging in. I meant what I said to her. It was true. As an actor, I resent when a writer tells me I should cry. But I'll say this. This actress was entirely committed to the emotional ride of her character, and it turns out, tears flowed. Not on command, but because of her connection to her character's point of view and her connection to her given circumstances and her moment before and her scene partner and her want. I love theater and I love film because I fall in love with characters. I want what they want because in good storytelling, they want it so hard. Exercising the muscles required for acting, directing, and writing, essentially bringing fictional characters to life, has toned me for appreciating people, everybody. Every person I see in this room and beyond is a character with a point of view. A set of paradoxical given circumstances, and many, many, many moments before. Theater and film, making them and also watching them, position me to love people. Not to necessarily understand or agree or root for people, but to appreciate that each person has a history and a primal want. Years ago, my parents and I were watching TV and stumbled upon a film adaptation of the bedtime story Goodnight Moon by Margaret Wise Brown. This was a 30-minute film that combined animated story pages, narration by Susan Sarandon, and interviews with the cutest kids about their bedtime routines. It was geared toward a toddler audience, but my parents and I erupted into laughter whenever a young kid came on screen to share their perspective on nighttime. When one kid asked what he thought Goodnight Moon was about, he replied, "It's kind of like a love story." I have to agree. Aren't most stories love stories? Aren't most days? Aren't most relationships? Aren't most lives? I love theater. I love film. I love writing and directing and acting. I love characters. I love the process of breaking apart a script and putting it back together. I love collaborating with all kinds of artists and technicians. I love the audience. You. I love you. this time together with you in this frame is kind of like a love story. I wonder what will happen next. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Nora. Thank you for sharing such a warm and welcoming and passionate talk with us today. We do have time for some questions. And again, for those of you watching virtually, you may submit questions using the live chat section on the YouTube. And now, while ushers collect any of your yellow cards, I'll begin with a question. I'm curious, if you had to choose only one role, writer, director, producer, actor, which would you choose and why?
The answer varies depending on what I have just worked on, usually. If my appetite has been sated by a great acting role, then I'm eager to start a project from the very beginning, maybe the writing stage. Right now, I think my appetite is most excited about directing. Directing is such a collaborative role. You must work with not only actors who I love, but also technicians and other artists, and be mindful of the audience the entire way through. So it exercises all the muscles. It's a really front-loaded position. There's a lot of prep work that goes in to directing a piece. And then there's this really challenging part where you have to let the piece go. And you have to let it the piece open for an audience and let it carry on its ride. Or in some cases, with the film, when the film is done and the film is in front of an audience, so many times you aren't there with them to share in the experience. So there's sort of a disembodied feeling with the art piece itself. And I think about that with writers and other artists who are not always alongside their audience. It's a major, major letting go. But fortunately, I love audiences and I trust them to have their own unique experience with the piece. So that's it can be a liberation too.
Thank you. We have a lot of questions here. You are clearly a very positive person. How do you deal with difficult actors to guide them in the direction you're envisioning?
Thank you. I can't think of a difficult actor right now. I truly, from the bottom of my heart, love actors, and I think it's because that's the foundation of my training. I think when there's difficulty in a rehearsal room, it's because the processes are different. And so that's when the habit of a director talking to the group, what might be necessary is to work with individuals in their own process. The expectation that everyone will work the same way is probably a false one. So the more I can connect with actors individually, I think the more helpful that is. And I discovered through writing this that the way into an actor is through figuring out what their character's point of view is, and then that becomes shared territory for us, so that we can always go to the playwright's intent or what the playwright has put on the table to be interpreted as a grounding place for us. And I think an actor has to feel like they're moving forward in order to keep moving forward. So there's no use in getting mired in a difficult place. It's about encouraging and championing what is going on.
Thank you. The next question is, in your movie, there could have been many different endings. Why did you choose the one you did?
Well, because we've just talked about wants, I believe that the protagonist in Another Happy Day, her deepest want is to feel seen. As a new mother, she doesn't feel seen as an individual. And the whole hour and a half is her search to feel seen in any way she can. And so the film ends, spoiler, with the baby looking at her mom and the mother feeling seen, the call and response. And so I knew early on that that is where I needed to get to. And it was the journey there I had to figure out. But I knew we were going from not feeling seen to feeling seen.
This is a comment. After you finished, my tears appeared, not on command. Thank you.
I love you.
It's a love story. How do you find the materials for the actor care packages?
Ooh, this is such a fun process. It's not a chore at all. It helps me figure out who I see as the character. I love for the images to be real photography or drawings or paintings, not borrowed imagery from other movies or plays. It is supposed to evoke feelings in the actor, so there must be some distance between the imagery and the text, and some distance between the actor and the character. There needs to be room. There needs to be room for multiple interpretations so that nothing is set and too firm at the beginning of a process. That needs to be the paint splattered on the walls. So I do a lot of research. And the tool that I find really helpful, and this is a very concrete answer, the tool that I find really helpful is Pinterest, because it's a visual mapping of imagery, and I can take images from all sorts of places and collect them. And then, because I really do enjoy graphic design, I can put it together in a smart little package so that it's not too much information, but it's just enough to launch.
I write what might be called poetry. How do I give my audience something other than a monologue?
I really love that question. When I'm writing, because I'm not always performing or writing something to perform, I imagine them. I imagine who it's for. Sometimes that can be a really clear image of an actual person, and sometimes it's sort of fuzzy or a composite. So in the process, I think about them, and I think about how they might respond to a line or to a scene. And then I, based on that, I continue to discipline myself to shift the expectations all along the way. Okay, so we just had that moment. I'm gonna trust that the audience got that. So next move, they're not expecting this. Or maybe they are expecting this and they're ready for something that they expected. So I think it's breaking it down and imagining someone that's helpful to your process. Early on in the early stages of Firelight, a really helpful supporter asked who she thought the workshop was for, who's our ideal audience. And I thought of two people in my head, and they were really different people. I was new in this community, so they were near strangers to me, but they represented two sides of what I hoped from Firelight. One of them is in the back row. an ideal audience member. And that those poles have been guideposts for a long time. And so I think as a writer, having some individuals that feel helpful to the process, that make things crackle for you, maybe different for every project. I think that's a useful tool.
Tell us about the role of the camera for you.
Ooh, that's where my imposter syndrome came in big time. With my film, Another Happy Day, I had done film projects in front of the camera and behind the camera, but the scale and scope of a feature film was something massive, way bigger than any one person. And because I was coming up through in film through acting and writing, I felt as a director I would sort of be on the hook for what lens we might need or what jargon was necessary for the to say for the light equipment. And this made me really nervous in advance of the project. So my response to those nerves was to create a 77-page document of my film broken down moment by moment, not scene by scene, but moment by moment, visually, with the subtext. This document, if you're curious, lives on the website, and you can just see how strong that imposter syndrome was based on this level of homework. I never, ever once looked at this document when I was on set. The act of preparing freed me on set. That discipline helped me understand where I wanted to place the camera for every moment because of what was going on in the scene. It was always, always informed by the relationships on screen and what the character wanted and what their point of view was. It always came from the characters. That is my process. There are much more visually forward creators, and I am very character-driven. So that helped me make decisions about the camera. And because of all of that excessive homework and making decisions on the fly on set, we were able to make new decisions for practical reasons that made sense because we had all prepared and knew what each scene and even each moment was about. So we could make new decisions based on that shared understanding.
Can you talk a bit about what inspired you to provide childcare on set and to limit your workdays to 8 hours on your first film?
This is something that I'm really proud of. For Another Happy Day, as you know, this is a postpartum depression comedy film. And so if I was going to dare to write about this very sensitive time in life, I wanted people aboard the project who had the experience of having children or caregiving. And so I wanted to make sure that that door was wide open for these collaborators. We provided childcare to cast and crew, and more remarkably, we shot 8-hour days. A typical day in film land is 10, 12, or 14-hour days because the budget is based on your days. Not based on your hours, it's based on how many days you shoot. So by writing 8-hour days into our schedule and therefore our budget, it was a commitment that the entire team was promising to commit to. So we stunned our crew by keeping to the 8-hour days, probably because of that 77-page document. All of that preparation informed the decisions to really economize and make decisions efficiently, but unhurried and with joy. By working 8-hour days, people who had any caregiving responsibilities, whether they had children or other parts of their lives, they were able to still have those parts of their lives. The notion that an artist must sacrifice their whole self for their art, I feel, might be an expired idea. I think we also are the artists we are very much because of the lives that we have. And I want to ensure that there is room for people to be themselves and bring that full self into the rehearsal room and onto set. It does not have to be a dual personality. We can be a whole person, hopefully, in all parts of our lives.
This is another comment. The park bench scene where she chases paper napkins blown away by the wind and the drink is spilled is masterful, genius enacted.
Oh, I have a comment about that, actually.
A comment about the comment?
Yeah, thank you for that. This was the one, maybe one moment I really put my foot down on set, and I didn't have to. So much of the time collaborators, we were working so seamlessly together because of the preparation, and I think because we were so rested, because we were only working 8-hour days. Which, by the way, I want to mention that the 8-hour days, I learned when we released the film, was the more radical provision. It was very important to me to provide childcare, and I really thank the Lyceum and the UU Church for initiating a childcare offering today downstairs, especially thanks to Serena McGovern for initiating it and coordinating it. This is a signal to people to say, hey, you're welcome here, you parent, whether you take advantage of the offering or not. But what was so interesting is that these 8-hour days our film was written up in Variety magazine as this radical production for having such short work days of 8 hours, real full, nice full day of hard work. But in this scene, some of the assistants brought some brown paper napkins to set with the smoothie. And I said, brown napkins. These have to be white napkins. There was something very visual about white napkins flowing through the air, like clouds. And they had to make a run and get the white napkins. But also, no one had brought a fan to blow the napkins, and it wasn't windy enough for the napkins to catch air. So there were all these really creative ideas, like these kinds of fans, trying to create as much air as possible. And ultimately what happened was we could not get these napkins to fly. And so our second assistant director started running through the neighborhoods and came back with a leaf blower. Like he was the man of the hour, and he armed himself with that leaf blower and blew the napkins into the air.
Okay, we have time for one more question, and we have quite a few more than one, so my apologies for those of you who didn't get your questions answered. I'm gonna try to combine two of them a little bit. What lessons do you have for politicians, and why don't more of our leaders and citizens try to imagine? Or how might you guide us to use creativity and our imagination in our day-to-day scenes?
Well, I remember when I went to acting school, I had a really fantastic acting teacher, and he would get really fired up if people said that that actors are so good at pretending. And he said, we never pretend. We tell the truth. And I believe, and I hope you know this by now, that the audience, any audience, can tell the difference between truth and pretend. And so, whether you're a politician or a teacher or anyone who has an ear of someone else, the job is to tell the truth and to open yourself up more. That is the ultimate gift, and I believe invites more people in, that's where the true exchange can happen. I do believe there's quite a responsibility when you have asked for people to listen to you. And I really thank you so much for coming today to listen to me and to Volkert and to Michelle. I do see you and I feel you. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Nora. I could see she was so uncomfortable. I was like, telepathically, you stay right there. You take that in. That you wanted them to love you? That's a sign of love in theater, the standing. So thank you so much for coming. Thank you for sharing, Nora. Just to mention that if you would like to see Nora's film, it is streaming on Prime, but also available by DVD at Toadstool. And I just want to thank everyone for your support of this season. And to invite you to join next Sunday, where the speaker will be Charles Coe, speaking about poetry for political and social change.